Welcome to Feminist Question Time. Feminist Question Time is brought to you by Women's Human Rights Campaign, which is the leading global organisation defending women's sex-based rights against the threats posed by gender identity ideology. There's more information on womensdeclaration.com, where you will find our Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights, which has been signed by 20,218 people from 140 countries, and is supported by 381 organisations. As well as signatories, we have activists. We have country contacts in 52 countries engaged in defending women's rights. If you'd like to get involved in either being a country contact or working with the country contact in your area, there's information and ways of getting in touch on our womensdeclaration.com website. This week on Feminist Question Time, we have Eugenia Rodriguez from Brazil. She's going to talk about Back to Reality, why we cannot afford as humanity the trans discourse. Then we have Denise McKenna, who is going to tell us and give us the links for the WIT survey that she's doing, and we hope we'll be able to share widely. Then we have Valerie Pelletier from Canada, survivor of prostitution, loses her job in a women's resource centre to gender identity ideology. And she will talk to us about that. And then we will have Kelly J. Keane, aka Posey Parker, from the UK, who will talk to us about extremism. What is extremism? And about her activism. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Eugenia Rodriguez. She's a Black, Brazilian Black woman, journalist, and spokesperson for No Corpo Certo, In the Right Body, a campaign against transing children.
Back to reality, why we cannot afford as humanity the trans discourse. The amount of damage created by the trans discourse cannot be ignored anymore. Brazil is one of the many countries in which healthy children are sterilized based on outdated stereotypes, where women are incarcerated with men and where people are punished for saying very obvious truths about what human beings are. Many of us try to solve this problem, keeping at least in some way the trans discourse alive. We try to establish a minimum age to body interventions, but stating they are okay for adults. We try to stop self-ID, but protect the category of real transsexuals. We state that human beings do not change sex, while we still use the expression trans people. I've been studying this issue since 2013, when Brazilian doctors allowed themselves to use puberty blockers and wrong sex hormones in minors. And I thought about many ways of solving what I used to see as a clash of rights, and now I see as a modern mass hysteria. The more I study, the more I talk to people around the world, and based on my personal experiences as a spokesperson of a campaign against medicalization of gender non-conforming kids, the more I conclude that we clearly must reject the whole trans narrative. We might try to stop body interventions on minors based on the belief of gender identity. And probably this will be one of the things we will live to see happening. But is it really ethical to cut off the breasts of lesbians when they are 22 and not 17? Is it really ethical to say to an 8-year-old boy that he's truly a girl, even if we do not allow doctors to change his body? Is it okay to lie to a child about such an important thing? Why should we trust health professionals to treat adults in an honest way when they profit from these cosmetic interventions and they know a proper therapy would probably end in no surgeries? Since so many health professionals identify themselves as trans or support this belief system, how do you stop them from forcing their faith on vulnerable patients of all ages? Plus, remember, poor families from countries with public health systems such as Brazil will take their kids to a public gender clinic, where they are not allowed to choose a therapist, let alone one who knows who Sasha Ayad and Stella O'Malley and or Lisa Marciano are. It's impossible for us to check if the child is or is not led by abusive, naive, attention seekers or homophobic parents. The case of British criminologist and the transitioner Richard Hoskins was a great lesson for us. If a 50-year-old man can be convinced that he's a woman, anyone can. The stories of the transitioners show that even when we are adults, we get caught in very vulnerable moments and make decisions we might regret. We cannot rely on this doctor's judgment. They prove it to us, they cannot be trusted. We might try to protect single-sex prisons and sports, which I also believe we will achieve during our lifetime. But what about places more pulverized, such as toilets and changing rooms? How are we supposed to protect them if men are able to change their sex in documents? Even if we require medical procedures before the change of certificates, how are we supposed to know if he had surgery? Will an average woman question these folks when they get into the female toilets, knowing that mere questions makes them lose their minds? Why should a man who cuts his penis have the right to enter these spaces, since his pattern or violence is the same as others? And even if he's a nice guy, he's not a woman anyway. Can every small business in the world, every little school in poor countries that sometimes does not even have toilet paper, really afford to build a third toilet? We might try to protect our freedom of expression to state in our private life and social media to the world that human beings cannot change sex. But what if you are talking to a trans-identifying person? How do we protect ourselves from accusations of transphobia when we are just stating facts? It might look easy to start calling your coworker Kevin by his new name, Khalid. It's just a name, what's the big deal? But even if Kevin recognizes that he did not change sex, that he must not enter female spaces, and even if Kelly or Kevin does not run for the affirmative politics in your company, at some point you will have to lie. At some point you will be forced to say to him that he's in some way a woman. You will be forced to pretend. You will be forced to pretend that gender identity is real, that his fantasies of womanhood are in some way real, when they're not. So it's very different from having a colleague which is religious, because at least in democratic countries, our religious colleagues are not allowed to force their beliefs on us. The lack of freedom of expression damages even the health of these dysphoric individuals, since doctors have to walk on eggs while talking to them. And these are just some of the problems. And the more people say they are trans, more citizens are affected in many unexpected ways. A lesbian follower of our Instagram account told me that her new therapist suggested she might be a trans man, even when she did not express any dysphoric feelings. When she questioned the psychologist, the woman said she has a trans kid and feels that she has to create a more inclusive environment. It's almost impossible to stop well-intended people from grooming, believing sincerely they are doing the right thing. Any kind of trans jeopardizes vulnerable people, especially gender non-conforming children and adults suffering from mental health issues or victims of abuse. Any kind of trans jeopardizes women and girls' rights, theories, and organizations. Any kind of trans jeopardizes our language, freedom of expression, our jobs, academic lives, statistics, health guidelines, politics, and our rights to tell the truth and live honest lives. any kind of trans denies what we truly are as humanity. We must stop lying. We must stop pretending that some people are trans, since, as we all know, no man could in any way be a woman, no woman could be in any way a man, and no one can be non-binary, agender, bigender. We must stop pretending that it's a right to be recognized as something you are not and force other people to lie. Some lies might cause no harm, such as telling children about Santa Claus or assuring a beloved friend we loved her new haircut. But not this lie. This is too big. We will end the problem not by recognizing the differences between women and trans women, or men and trans men, and between us and other thousands of gender labels, but stating that no man can be a woman, no woman can be a man, none of us can become a third type of human being. And that's all. No one is transsexual, transgender, non-binary, polygender, or any kind of trans. No change is possible or needed. We will end this problem not by saying children cannot consent with this so-called treatment, and not only saying that children cannot consent to this kind of treatment, but even adults. Healthy parts of the human body being removed is not a treatment. That's why we stopped lobotomies. We remember that. We all must state relentlessly the truth that the emperor is naked, o imperador está nu.
Can you give us a quick update on the situation in Brazil? Is at the moment, or just news, has anything been happening on the trans issue?
Recently, our Supreme Court reinforced a decision of years ago that men have the right to enter on female prisons. The judgment is not completely finished, so we have still a chance to change this decision. Children, precisely today, I had this news that attorneys in the state of São Paulo are forcing the registrations bureau to change certificate of children based on their parents' will. And we do have some good news. And there is a project to stop these interventions in the state of São Paulo. And this project advanced a little bit. We choose the people there, the politicians, they choose what we say, a relator, which is a politician will be responsible for this bill. So it's like a baby step. But we shouldn't know. I mean, it was here in Brazil, people and institutions were totally captured. I mean, attorneys and public defenders and lawyers, organizations, and the psychologist organization. I mean, we do have here a normative that forbids psychologists to question gender identity, always using the comparing with sexual orientation, all that bullshit about being a conversion therapy. And academics here are very, very colonized by queer theory. All these things that I see people talking about around the world, I mean, in United States and United Kingdom, it's very similar here. It's very similar here. I mean, even the jargons, even the way these young people are talking and like this pansexual thing, and it's very similar.
It sounds as if in the whole of Latin America, all of South America, it's been implemented very, very fast. How about public reaction? Are more people turning against it or questioning it like we have in England or in Britain?
Yeah. I think that the average Brazilian person does not buy this bullshit. But the problem is that although they do not buy it, I mean, they are not doing, I mean, practical things, to change this. And mostly, I think that because Brazil has so many problems. I mean, we have so many economics and political problems, you know, some urgencies they have on their daily lives. They do not take the time, you know, to fight against this. I mean, most people do not have a very close person that identifies as trans. They are do not so politicized. So, but at least this, they do not buy. They just think it's a bunch of crap.
So we're now going to go to Denise McKenna. She's from the UK. She's devised with other people a W8IT survey. She's going to quickly recap what that is, and we're going to put the links in because it's now ready to go. Denise talked about it a couple of weeks ago and it sounds really great, but over to you, Denise, to explain it, and we'll put the links in.
Okay, hi. Yes, so I'm from Women Is This, and I did speak at the webinar a couple of weeks ago about the Women Is This survey, or the WIT survey that we're carrying out. We're a collective of women who are carrying out this survey to collect data on the impact of gender identity ideology on women's mental health. And the aim is to gather large-scale empirical data that can be shared with policymakers, practitioners, researchers, the general public, shared with everyone. So I'm only speaking briefly today to remind you of the survey and to tell you that it's now live and it's ready for you to complete. So please, please complete the survey and share the link widely amongst all of the gender critical women, or the radical feminists, the lesbian feminists that you know, and also within the similar, you know, groups that you belong to. And obviously, the more replies we receive, the greater weight the survey will carry, the greater weight the results will carry. Now, it's a fairly long survey. It takes a minimum of 30 minutes to complete. It can take much longer, depending on how much you want to say. And it does cover many aspects of gender identity ideology. It did occur to us that the length of the survey might put some women off of completing it. We had to weigh that against the importance of obtaining comprehensive data. And we decided in the end to go for a longer survey that will give us a greater range of information. So there are 8 sections in the survey. These are general questions, children and young people, holding gender critical views, lesbian erasure, women and professional spaces, information and misinformation. Then there's a section on more disparate issues. And finally, that's followed by some demographic questions about you. And you will have the opportunity to write at length about these issues, but you don't have to if you don't want to. There are many questions that can be answered with a simple tick and a tick box. It's up to you how much you want to put in, because we're collecting both quantitative and qualitative data. So the survey is not aimed at any one group of women. For example, it's not specifically aimed at women who live with ongoing mental health problems. It's for all women to complete, because we believe that gender identity ideology is harmful to all women in multiple ways. And we believe that it is an existential threat to all women. If, however, you do live with mental health problems, ongoing mental health problems, and the imposition of gender identity ideology has made these problems worse, then we want to know about that too. And it's important that we record and report on all of the harms we're experiencing as a result of this ideology. And it seems to me that we have been, and we continue to be, victims of some kind of crime that's happening on an industrial scale. And I see this survey in terms of some kind of victim impact statement. So it will enable us to give our collective and individual testimonies. And I spoke previously about the importance of us understanding the social and political causes of mental distress. And it's vital that we make this link between mental and emotional distress and what is happening in society, because the distress that we are experiencing doesn't emanate from within us, but it's a normal response to a society that holds women in contempt. And we must shout from the rooftops about the harms that their actions are causing us, hold them to account, and bring these harms to an end. And remember also that any mental or emotional distress that, that you experience has a negative effect on your general functioning in many areas of your life. So where society causes us this kind of harm, we're being put at a disadvantage in multiple ways, and we're being discriminated against on a very large scale. So we want women from all countries to complete the survey. Unfortunately, it's only available in English because we have limited resources. If you want to translate it into another language, that would be fine, but we would require the results to also be translated for us. Now, the survey should be completed by the 4th of December 2021, so there's quite a lot of time, and we will produce a full report early next year, which we will be using in numerous ways, from lobbying organisations to informing the public and a whole load of other things. And we will be promoting the results of the survey aggressively, and they will be available there for all of you to use as you see fit. The information you share with us will only be used in a way that respects your anonymity, unless you agree for it to be used differently. So we're therefore asking you to make us aware if you're willing to speak publicly, whether that's openly or you want your name and voice to be anonymous, but you're happy to speak and have that published about what you're experiencing and what you have experienced. So we'll be using the final report, as I say, in a very forceful way to ensure that women's mental well-being is always at the centre of any discussion about gender identity ideology. And the, of course, the findings, the survey findings, will be available for all of us to use as a collective resource, all of us women, not just the women in WIT. And I would just say, like say finally, that it's very timely that it's being launched this weekend, because tomorrow is World Mental Health Day. And there are a few things in this society more important than the mental well-being of women. So, and you can email us if you want any further information or if you want to comment in the survey in any way. Email address is witsurvey2021@gmail.com, and that's all lowercase. Thank you.
We're now going to hear from Valerie Pelletier. Valerie Pelletier is from Canada. She's a survivor of prostitution, and she's going to talk. She's an artist and a militant, and also goes by the name Legal Tender. She's a singer and a street musician, and contributes regularly to radical feminist discussions in interview or in print.
I'm going to be speaking about the very surreal situation I found myself in, where I was working in a women resource and I lost my job to gender identity ideology. If I set the table first, I guess what makes my story even more outrageous is the fact that from my previous life experience, I am exactly the kind of woman that this resource would have been helping 10, 20 years ago. And now I'm in a place of giving back, of dealing with my trauma and really wanting to help women escape the sex industry. And so I made a choice to only work in nonprofit. For the last 12, 15 years, I've pretty much only worked for nonprofits, which usually means accepting lower pays in order to do something that fits with your values. But these are where my priorities are. And at this point where I had this job, I was actually not working as a counselor because I needed a break from the mental load. I had a relapse of a PTSD symptom from having an armed robbery happen to me about 4 years ago. And so feeling still vulnerable and not wanting to take on such heaviness, I was in kind of like taking care of myself mode, where I decided to do what I do is to kind of go back to like cleaning jobs or the kind of job where you don't have any mental load and you're very physical. And so I found this job in a community agency where I was working in the donations department. So I was receiving the donation, deciding what's good to keep or to reuse, cleaning it, making it reusable. And so I actually love that job because you're working in a warehouse. It's like you're super busy. You got truckloads of stuff coming in all the time. The music is playing and you receive teams of volunteers where you're like team working, and it's very dynamic. So it was really what I needed at the time. What needs to be clear is that in my job, I had no incidents on anyone in the organization. I was really in the basement working in Stocking Donation. I didn't have a say. I was not working as a counselor with the women using the resource. So basically my political views had no incidence on the organization. And so basically what happened is I had been working there for about 9 months when suddenly I get called into the HR office, and the men working at the HR, and that's something else I would like to point out, that more and more you have a lot of men in deciding position working in women agency. I mean, they are allowed to do what they want, but I am allowed to voice my reservation. So the reason why I didn't end up in his job with his diplomas is because I had the life I had. So, you know, hello. And so basically I get called into his office, and within 25 minutes, I was fired. And he tells me he's received some screen captures of my activism that I do online on social media, that someone, one or more person had reported me to my workplace as a transphobic person, that, and putting pressure on my agency, that on my community agency, that basically it's unacceptable of them to have such, to employ such a transphobic person. And they caved in really fast. The words "you're transphobic" were used, the expression "trans women" or "women" were used and confirmed to me as a statement that they abide by, which again, they are technically speaking allowed to do that. But my dissension was happening outside of work in my private life, where I am gender critical and my posts are about that, and my intervention on various feminist forums are about that, and I am allowed. This is protected by law. This is my right to consciousness, to free speech in my own life. And again, my political position had no incidence on the inner working of the agency or even on the clientele with whom I was barely in contact with. I could just maybe meet them, but I was not working in the housing part of the resource. So my opinion not only had no incidents, but I have a charter right to my opinion. And so when I realized how high up on his values he was describing them as accepting trans women as women and so on, I decided to use my firing time to explain my views, because being called transphobic is starting to be really terrible. Like, I've had it. So I said, well, if this is the situation, well, I'm gonna tell you what I defend against trans people. I'm for women's rights. And at the moment, it feels like we have inadequation between sex-based protected characteristic and a newly protected gender characteristic, which are incompatible. Because if you change the definition of women, also, like, as a radical feminist survivor of the sex industry, my entire analysis on what the sex industry is and does is sex-based. Reading Andrea Dworkin saved my life, because as a survivor, I did not come to feminists out of the intellectual luxury of finding it, oh, it's cool, I'm gonna be a feminist. No, we come at it from an urgency of understanding and of finding a way to not feel so guilty about, because on one hand, you have society telling you you've made bad choices. And when you used to hold work discourse while you were in the industry, when you get out, that discourse has no explanation. Nothing is trauma informed about it. Nothing will tell you why you feel the way you feel, why you have all these physical symptoms. And then you feel guilt doors that ideology of sex work is where, because I'm binging me for free anyway, so at least now I'm, and all the reasoning that women in the industry need to tell themselves in order to survive, because nobody likes to feel like a victim. And so when, after having exited the sex industry, and I needed to up in a feminist agency that understood that I needed to understand and unpack in order to heal. And so my counselor at the time, it's back 7 or 8 years ago, introduced me to radical feminist analysis. And I mean, the hair on my raising just shattering when you have such a large system, a systemic need above you to sacrifice women to the sex industry. So it was groundbreaking for me to have this understanding of how we had such a thing as a sex class oppressing another sex class. An entire understanding in my approach to helping women came from that understanding. And now you're removing me the need to understand the world as different opposing sex classes. And you're telling me that we being a woman is a feeling or a costume. And I know that we sound terribly mean when we say that, but I'm gonna give you an example. I'm speaking with another counselor recently, and she tells me, well, you in the shelter where I work, we allow boys to stay with their mother up until they're 13, but after 13, they become men. So she's telling me that. And at the same time, trans women are women. So I'm like, so you'll have grown ass men at your shelter because they say they feel like a woman. So you are really telling me that woman is a feeling to you. But yeah, the 14-year-old boy, he's becoming a man. So this could be threatening to the women at the shelter. Are you serious? It's so surreal. So the biggest feeling I have from this gender ideology madness is that it's like a giant gaslighting. I feel everywhere like we're taking away my tools to analyze the situation. We're not helping me. We're not letting me name the problem and explain to women their own oppression. Not all women have their period. It's so, but within community services, it's even worse. Women who are used the services, if they complain that they're housed with a man or be a man, they get completely gaslit. So it's like, you know, it is obvious to us who are on the inside and who suffer this ideology that it's just a rebranding. I was on an online training recently. Out of 34 attendees for the class, 8 people had their pronoun. It's surreal. Like most of the people posing us gender, so flabbergasting to me that so on board with that. So back to my hiring story. I explained to the person firing me my political position and then I try to go into accommodations. I tell him, well, I'm ready. I'm absolutely ready to not talk about any activism at work. Like I can avoid all these topics, even though, I mean, when you're working in a warehouse, you're speaking about anything. You're like, are you going to vote? Are you going to you're having political conversation because you're just working at one topic you're not allowed to talk about to keep your job. I would have caved in, and I mean, I'm not at work to be an activist, but none of my proposed accommodation made sense to him. For him, I was a threat from the way I think, because the way I think is trans exclusive. And suddenly, basically, you're telling me, and also during the time I was at the resource, I personally saw 3 trans people and 1 full male bodied being housed there. So on a resource that will say in their annual report that they need to refuse 10 to 12 women a day, so many requests they have for housing, within the, I don't know how many amount of women they can house at the time, but within that, there was sometimes 1, even 2 trans people. I don't know. I'm not gonna be able to go into all the details that I would like to, but if people are believing that women is something you add onto yourself or subtract onto yourself, and that making all these very aesthetic accommodations make you a woman, and behaving in a very stereotypical way makes you a woman, and it's exhausting. I don't know. I'm sorry, I'm out of word right now. It's just when you're on the ground living it, it's absolutely surreal. And so I explained my views. I tried to stay very polite and diplomatic. I offered accommodations to be able to keep my job, and he just told me, no, your values are incompatible with our association. And because your values seems to be very firmly held and you're not going to change about them, then therefore you're not in the right place here. And so I was fired like that. And then they went on to try to make it seem like I had left on my own, out of my own accord. But I was saying, no, you put me in front of a non-choice. The non-choice was you either think like us if you want to stay, or because your views are too strongly held, therefore you don't fit. So I was in front of a non-choice. They didn't offer me any ways to stay. And so he phrased it like, because your values are so held strongly, you will agree that you're not in your place here. To which I replied, well, I guess, what do you want me to do? And then the whole firing felt violent in an HR way, you can't go back to your locker, you cannot go back to say goodbye to your colleagues, we forbid you from entering into contact with your manager, basically that whole part of your life stops existing. And then 2 weeks after, COVID lockdown. So the depression it put me through was really profound, because I was like, I am exactly the kind of woman who's supposed to give back and help. And these resources are made, technically speaking, for women like me. And now this gender ideology has taken over everything. And most people comply with it because they don't want to be the bad transphobe person that gets excluded. It's just, it's extremely exhausting. So that's what launched me into having to kind of take action. So at first I was wondering, what can I do with that? Where can I take this to get legal advice? And after receiving several different advices, I had to settle on small claims courts because basically I had not worked there long enough to be eligible to the free defense offered by labor law. Because I'd only worked there 9 months and I would have needed to have worked there 2 years to be defended by labor court. Then I tried the Human Rights Commission. Initially, they received my complaint, the Human Rights Commission, okay? They initially received my complaint and deemed it as legitimate and that it was part of the umbrella of political discrimination. But then a year after, they flipped. They said, your complaint is irreceivable. Because, and the way they voiced it is like, because community agencies are allowed to discriminate based on certain criteria. And I'm like, yes, as in if you're in a woman resource, they are allowed to only hire female staffers, like stuff like that. There are clauses that allow an agency to kind of do a positive discrimination for the meaning of their work. But this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about my views are considered transphobic, and therefore, because now they've decided to open up the description of women as including trans people. I never say trans women, they're not a kind of woman, they are a kind of gender non-conforming male. So I don't get into that. I try to be very careful with words because words carry meaning and they shape the ideas that people have access to. So now I'm at the point of I am waiting for my court date. It should be in about 2.5 years. The position of my ex-employer has been from the start that they refuse to negotiate. They will not settle out of court. And I'm claiming damages, which according to jurisprudence, I'm entitled to as per cases of political discrimination. And there's an aggravating factor to the fact that it was deliberate of them to do that. It's not an accident. They said they literally did that to me. So I'm entitled to claim a certain amount. It is known that when you're in small claims courts, you're claiming an amount that is below $15,000. So this is how vague I can tell you about my situation. I'm claiming damages to them. Their position is firmly, they deny any wrongdoing. So it's gonna be settled in 2.5 years in court. Then I'm still wondering what to do about the Human Rights Commission, because the fact that they chickened out on my claim and preferred to defend the protected characteristic of gender ideology and the right of my employer to exclude me because I don't abide to gender ideology. I'm trying to get legal advice and to see if there is a French Canadian lawyer who would be courageous enough to maybe take on the Human Rights Commission. Because if we let them do that, they are picking and choosing whichever case they want to defend. And at the moment, we've seen with the case of Jessica Yaniv that they are really inclined to want to defend the trans ideology at the expense of women's sex specific rights. So this is it's very exhausting actually. And I'm not even like, I mean, my case is nothing compared to some people who go on to like heavy court case that will take 5 to 6 years to like settle. So, and it's already exhausting at my level. And it's you have to like, it's a language. It's like, to decide to pursue these kinds of cases is difficult. You need a lot of help, a lot of support. You need to fundraise for your legal expenses. So that's what I've been doing. I've been just not accepting that this was done to me. And I'm obviously doing it to get the damages for myself, because as a survivor, I don't accept it. Like, I'm like, how dare you do this to me? But also to try to create some precedent so that other women eventually will be like, well, you know, you cannot fire me for that. And here's an example that went to court. Because if none of us take these cases to court, then nothing's going to happen in jurisprudence. So that's the situation.
We're now going to go to the chat. We're going to have a conversation with Kelly J. Keene. So Kelly J. Keene, Posey Parker, has an incredibly popular and fantastic YouTube channel where she talks about what's going on her mind and is just incredibly insightful huge amounts of the time. So what do you think is going on with this extremism thing?
So the idea of extremism was something that somebody said about Julia Long and myself. And I think where it comes from now is that women, even though standing supposedly on the side of women, have capitulated so much of our language that the word woman is seemingly abrasive and coarse, impolite, rude, and far too much for the delicate ears of a polite society. And so I think it's that extremism, because everybody has moved, everybody's tried to find middle ground, which I think is a nonsensical idea when it comes to women's rights. We either have them or we don't. If we capitulate any of it, if we share any of our so-called rights, which I understand my foremothers fought very, very hard for, if we give up any of those and allow anyone to come in as an act of kindness, which actually I think is a dishonest idea, I think it's very unkind to women, then it's just really peculiar that that is called an extremist position. I would have thought that was the position.
Yeah, and what I mean, it must be strange for you because you're painted as an extremist within the gender critical world, like so extreme that you're sort of beyond the pale, really, that a lot of women would say, oh, no, that's, you know, that's really much too extreme for me. And but then your audience is actually much more mainstream on many views. So it's you're reaching just everybody, I imagine. Oh, so how do you, what's going on there? What do you think's happening?
I don't know. We did this protest outside the Lancet yesterday, and people driving delivery trucks, people like both sexes, but majority men, I would say, female ambulance drivers, they all beeped and cheered and kind of got it, knew what was going on. I don't think any of those have read a feminist text. I don't think they've got any theoretical understanding as to why they don't want men in women's spaces. Normal people who do tangible, consequential things in their lives, who have to pay a mortgage and live normal, kind of two mortgage payments away from homelessness people, they perfectly understand what's at stake. They have discussions in pubs about not wanting their daughters to walk home alone. That doesn't mean they're not incredibly sexist often themselves, but they do recognize the danger that men pose to women. It's only when you seem to get a little bit lofty in more privileged households and jobs, more comfortable, that people then try and intellectualize this. There's nothing intellectual about not wanting a man in a woman's space. It's a really basic instinctive compulsion that we don't want men in our space.
And so, and what about the Lancet? You did a demo, and I thought, to be honest, I thought some of the people beeping, because I was watching it either live or just afterwards, and it was fantastic, because I thought some of them might have been beeping about the dinosaurs, because you had these fantastic dinosaurs. But will you tell our viewers, because we have loads of women from all over the world and a few men, what were the dinosaurs for?
Right. Let me just assure you that actually we were leafleting most of those people when they were stopped at the traffic lights before they came and beeped. So I'm just going to stick to the story that they were 100% behind our activism. The dinosaurs is because a politician called David Lammy, who continually covers himself in glory when it comes to women's rights, said a number of things. So David Lammy is in one of the poorest parts of London. There is incredibly high rates of child sexual exploitation. And David Lammy thinks it's fine to talk against safeguarding. And one of the things he said is that women in the Labour Party were hoarding rights, and that we were dinosaurs. So actually, it's old fashioned and we should become extinct. It's an old fashioned concept to keep women's rights just for women. He also thinks that in sex reassignment surgery, which I can't find an honest way of calling that surgery what it really is, but in what they call sex reassignment surgery, that men actually have a cervix created. So that was why it sort of most of the protests and the actions that I do, they start off with a bit of an idea, a bit of a like what we want to achieve. And Katie's idea was the dinosaurs in David Lammy's constituency. And then we looked, and there wasn't really anywhere really good that you could sort of talk to people in his constituency. So we switched that to the Labour Party, and I was already doing a Lancet protest. So we just combined the two.
You were outside the Lancet magazine or news, like, and then did you go to the Labour Party as well? So you did two. Oh, yeah. Brilliant. And so one thing is I'm interested in, I guess, some of our some of the other women here. Where do you get your ideas from? And how do you sort of work out which one's going to work and which isn't? Because I think some women might not know, but Kelly J's been running monthly Speakers Corner meetings for the last year, which are maybe year and a half, which are just really well attended and very dynamic and creative spaces and very inspirational, being out there and politically very powerful. But where do you get the ideas to do all these things?
Sometimes they're not my ideas, sometimes they're other people's, or somebody sort of mentioned something, and I'm just a bit of a, well, I didn't know I was a bit of a doer, but I am a bit of a doer. So if someone says something and they're like, oh, that might be an idea, I think, well, let's do it then. Let's just do it. Let's see if it works. I don't mind failing. I don't mind being wrong. And so that probably does help me just move forward with ideas. But often it's about, everything for me comes from, how do I tell people what's happening? That's simply what I want to do. I want everybody to know what's happening. Because if by consent and by fight and by normal gradual social change things happen, that's one thing. But this is a top-down coercive manipulation of the public against women. So it's just about telling people where the ideas come from, everywhere and anywhere. I'm just the person to actualize them and to move them forward.
And I mean, one of the things is that existing organizations who have things like bank accounts and structures, and they've known each other, say, through a political party for 20 years, and they know, oh yeah, if we're going to Bristol, we're going to call on so-and-so, and we'll get so-and-so to speak, and we'll get these other people. They've been working together for many years, and it's one of the reasons it's so disastrous that institutions are being captured. And you have emerged as a real sort of political force, you and working with loads of other people, but from not being part of an institution. And how have you managed to, how do you reach people to get people to come to your demos? I mean, that's a big issue. How do we get women on the streets, or men and women? How have you done that?
I think through YouTube, that's been quite good. And I've been interviewed by sort of other people, some dodgy people, but mostly nice other channels have interviewed me. And so that's been quite a reach. A couple of people outside the van shouted, "Hey, Posey," yesterday. And then somebody in the pub, I've been on talk radio a little bit recently. And so they said, "Oh, I've seen you on talk radio." This is all sort of young men. So I think that's how I'm getting them to do it. And what I'm not doing when they get there is I'm not doing what they might expect. So I understand the audience here. But if you mention the word feminism to some of the people who come to my meetings, they won't come. They don't want to be lectured about, maybe they think that they can't have relationships with their husbands anymore. They mustn't love their sons, or they must try and live a separatist lifestyle. Now, I don't think that is what all feminists might say, but that is the perception. And so I'm not asking people, I'm just telling people what is going on and to make up their mind and basically see common sense. So I think that's attractive. I'm not asking too much of people. I'm just saying, come and listen. I think you'll agree with me. It's feminism is a big ask for a lot of women, because a lot of women don't want to understand exactly what's happening to them. They don't want to know the reason that they do all of the housework and they don't get paid as much and they get relied upon for unpaid labor. because actually there's a whole system against them. They don't want to know about that. So I don't offer it.
I mean, it's such a complicated struggle, and it's on so many different levels. It seems as if many of us are choosing different ways to work and taking different angles, and some of them work incredibly well and some of them aren't so good, or they might be just doing sort of other work that's helpful. So what you're doing is particularly good as well, because it's very effective. I mean, another question I have is that you, as far as I can see, you get things like 7,500 people watch some of your like Friday night chats. You just sort of get on and say, and how's that happened? Did it start off like that, or has it always been?
The first one I did before Facebook removed it in about 2 days got about 50,000 views. And that was a long time ago, but I'd been to a feminist meeting. I use that word quite loosely because it wasn't feminist. It was very woke. And they had a poster up that they designed themselves about terrible turfs. And I was animated and I was quite cross, and I can speak quickly and coherently, and people quite liked it. And I was relatively funny, I think, and swore a lot, and it got shared a lot. And people, you know, I said the unsayable, because I think that's not my role. It's everybody's role to say the unsayable, quite frankly, but I'll actually do it. And so it was quite popular. So I thought, well, I'll start doing things, and people started watching. And so I continued, and it has grown. It's grown gradually. I think I've got about 40,000 subscribers now.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So and I mean, the thing that I find interesting is that, Women's Human Rights Campaign, we're a network, and we have 52 country contacts, and we have a declaration and a web page, and we're working in a sort of in the tradition of the women's movement, second wave sort of working together, being quite collaborative, and we've got the Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights, which is our sort of key document, and we try to stick to talking in that language, and we keep going back to that, and we're, I think we sort of make a compromise because we don't want to swear or say or whatever, say too much that could look bad for the organisation. I think it's good that we've developed an organisation from scratch in 2 years, but it's also fantastic that you've got the freedom to just say what you think and make mistakes, and it's not, you're not going to get loads of people annoyed with you. Well, do you get people writing in and sort of saying, oh, you shouldn't have said that?
No, well, I occasionally do, but it's rarely about my main topic. So it's rarely about women. Sometimes men will complain that they feel there's some anti-men stuff going on. And I just don't have any patience for that anymore. I probably used to say, I love my husband, I've got 3 sons. And I just think, well, if you don't know about that by now, then I don't really care. But I do think once you collaborate, once you're in an organization, of course you're restricted because everybody is invested. It's pretty much me. And so if I want to say it, I can take the flak. And actually, I don't get attacked as much as people who maybe do try and deliver something a lot more reasonable, because I just don't have any patience. So if I want to say a man is a man, and actually most of them make us feel uncomfortable if they put women's clothes on, if we were all really honest, when men do cross-dress, unless he has a totally different feel than most of the men I've ever encountered cross-dressing, they do make women feel uncomfortable. And I don't think that's because we're all terrible transphobic bigots. I think it's because most of us have a really guttural instant response to something that we don't feel is particularly honest and poses a threat. And I think there is an undercurrent of that. And I think somebody should be able to, someone's got to be able to say it. Now, I know the lovely Sheila Jeffries is in your room somewhere, and Sheila will say it. And obviously she is a terrible extremist. But she'll say it, Julia will say it, Dr. Julia Long will say it, but there's not many people who are just willing and able to say it without the shackles of the approval of many other people that are relying on everybody delivering the same message. And both of those things is absolutely necessary for a movement, because I won't bring everybody on board. An academic feminist is not gonna go, do you know what? That woman who just shoots from the hip with her peroxide blonde hair and face full of makeup, she is the woman for me.
How do you cope emotionally with being sort of ostracized by some groups?
Don't know what you mean, Jo. How do I cope? Well, I have had moments where I've been really, really, really upset. A couple of times, actually, and one was an organization and one was an individual where I just felt I was absolutely enraged and in tears on both of those occasions. But it doesn't last for very long because I'm not in it. I'm sure most of us are like this. I'm not in it for personal glory. I'm not in it because I want to find loads of friends. I do it because I think it's right. And so I can't be distracted to those people by those people and by that emotion. And I just compartmentalize it off. And actually, I think the winning is in the reaching your destination, which is to stop this assault on women's rights. That's the win. And the win is to just remain quite resolute and not get embroiled in these things, because even when I've been attacked, if I say a single word in my own defense, people call it infighting. And so I have got quite a good brain for just putting something in a box and just keeping it there and not really, you know, it doesn't spin around my head that much. The things that keep me up at night are girls having double mastectomies in the United States of America, not whether some blue tick feminist likes me. I just think that this is the fight of our lives, right? There's so many other things that are happening to women that none of those things you can talk about if we're not talking about women, if we can't actually say what a woman is. I've decided this is an unreality. That's what we're heading for, is an unreality, a severance of family. And I don't mean a nuclear mum, dad, kids family. I mean familial biological connections. And if we're not standing up and ignoring the noise, and that there are some difficult women in this movement, some very unpleasant women in this movement, but if we can't ignore them, if we don't think what we're heading for is important enough just to, I'm nobody, I'm not important at all when it comes to this. My dispute with somebody is nothing in comparison to the threat, the global threat against women. So that's all I want to say.